to familiarize more of the state leaders about the Regional Extension Center proposal that we put together, especially now that it's been funded, to learn more about Key Health Alliance, which is the group that is putting together the Regional Extension Center, to get your feedback and some of your input on helping us better serve your constituents. To my immediate left is Jennifer Lundblad, who is the CEO and president from Stratus Health. I'm Marty Wittrack. I'm the dean of the School of Nursing at the College of St. Scholastica, also on the board of the Rural Health Resource Center. And then to my far left is Tammy Lichtenberg, who is the executive director for the Center for Healthcare Innovation at Scholastica. As many of you know, there were that the ARA Act was created last year to advance health information technology in the national scene to kind of improve, in general, health care quality and safety. There were several programs under that bill. Ours is one, the Regional Extension Center, but there were a number of workforce bills that were offered, several of which have been submitted through Minnesota at the community college level, and the College of St. Scholastica and the University of Minnesota submitted one at the university-based level. We've not heard anything yet about the research center proposals. The HIE extension grant was awarded to the state of Minnesota just recently, and then ours is the Regional Extension Center. So these extension centers were really national programs trying to help support priority primary care providers to adopt and meaningfully use electronic health records. This is the goal of this is to improve the quality and safety of care and also to protect eligible providers from losing their qualification for Medicare and Medicaid incentive payments. And these funds are managed by the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. And we will say that they are not usually a grant-making agency, and we've been waiting quite a long time to get that through the pipeline. So, Key Health Alliance, who are they? This is a group of three institutions that had partnered before this RFP to come together around issues primarily affecting rural and underserved populations. When this grant came out, we thought it was a natural for us because we had those common shared interests, and we brought a potpourri of skills and abilities that we thought would really position us well. We received letters of support from nearly 50 organizations in Minnesota and North Dakota. Stratus Health is, as many of you well know, a nonprofit agency based in the Twin Cities for healthcare quality and safety. They're experts at facilitating improvement in people and communities. They have a strong track record already of working with practices around electronic health record implementation and technical assistance. And when every state in the nation had implementation of HIT in clinics, they had the best retention rate of any other state. The College of St. Scholastica has been for almost 100 years developing healthcare workforce, especially in nursing. We have significant experience in electronic health records. We have a partnership with the Cerner Corporation that has allowed us to take their tool and use it as a teaching learning tool for health professions. Many facilities use that here in Minnesota, in Minsky. The College of St. Catherine uses that. And we have other folks who have used it in Oregon, Ohio, and many other states. We received two awards at a national level for this, and we have been working also doing technical assistance on federal projects, particularly in Aiken County and in Brainerd at St. Joe's Hospital. The Rural Health Resource Center is a national nonprofit based in Duluth. They serve as a knowledge center for rural hospitals and healthcare providers. They've provided the technical assistance to critical access hospitals nationally. They've been awarded many federal contracts for health information technology, performance improvement. They're all about building capacity in rural communities, leaving skills and abilities there, not just coming in as an expert consultant. We called our program, our proposed program, REACH, which is the Regional Extension and Assistance Center for HIT. We really orchestrated a very inclusive process, brought together a lot of stakeholders, heard word from many of the folks who would be the recipients of this help. And we really felt like we put together a proposal that really pulled our skills and abilities together, leveraged the really strong resources we have in Minnesota through the eHealth Advisory Committee, and we're working closely with the HIE efforts in Minnesota and North Dakota, as well as the Medicaid offices. I will tell you that part of the reason that we partnered with North Dakota is for this proposal there were a minimum number of providers that needed to be served, and North Dakota did not feel they could probably reach that threshold on their own.
Great. Thanks, Marty, and thank you again to all of you for inviting us to join you this afternoon. The way you might think of this federal program should kind of ring true to us here in Minnesota and the upper Midwest. The idea of HIT, Health Information Technology Regional Extension Centers, is a model that's really built on agriculture extension. It's the idea that we can put people out in communities, experts in the community, in the field, to help hospitals, clinics, and others use technology better. So the whole idea of this program that we just on Friday got the official word that we were successful in our proposal for Minnesota and North Dakota is that we will have a program here across these two states where you might imagine we're going to have staff embedded across communities in both Minnesota and North Dakota helping providers to better use technology. So this was, as Marty indicated, a federal program. The first round of two total rounds of applications started back in August. The federal government says they're going to award up to 70 of these, and they just on Friday announced the first 32, where our proposal was among those 32. It's for $19 million. And another thing that might bring a smile to all your faces is we're not here to ask for money. We're here to tell you we got federal money to bring to this state and to North Dakota. So great resources to bring to bear to continue to advance how we are improving health and doing that using technology. So it does have a matching component to it. The Fed said they don't want to be entirely responsible for the funding and the dollars. So over the total of 4 years, $19 million will come from the federal government, but there will be varying percentages over the first two and the latter 2 years of what we will seek other grants and potentially fees from providers to be able to make this program work. If you go to the next slide, I think this is a really critical component. The federal government is providing, through this program, what you might think of as subsidized assistance for priority primary care providers. But what we know, and our experience here in Minnesota and across our three organizations, is that if we're not paying attention fully across the continuum of care, that includes nursing homes, it includes home care, it includes public health, then we're really not serving the citizens and the patients of Minnesota well. So the federal funding will subsidize the primary care providers, and we are committed to finding ways to do our work of providing technical assistance in the REACH program across all providers. These next two slides list for you the overall goals we have for the program, but they're not all equally weighted. I would draw your attention to this first one, which is really the core of the program, which is providing technical assistance to healthcare providers so that if they don't have an electronic health record now, we can help them make a wise choice about what's going to work well in their practice and with their patients. And if they do already have an electronic health record, how can we help them maximize it? What we know today is that most providers, even if they have an EHR, are not using it to its full capability. We have not done a very good job in healthcare around using technology in this way. So that first goal is really the core of the program. We also, moving to number two, intend to continue the broad participation from industry, from education, from state government, and from many, many stakeholders that we had as part of our proposal process. Part of what our work will be is number three, which is actively disseminating best practices as they emerge and research with regard to how to improve healthcare quality and protecting privacy and security of health information, which is critical in this realm. If you go to the next slide, we really want to make this practical and actionable. Again, think of this extension model from agriculture. It's really about the practical implementation of things that will improve care. And we want to utilize expertise that exists across a number of federal and state agencies as well. And then we want to be sure that we're helping integrate HIT into the initial and ongoing training of health professionals. Marty referenced that there are also kind of complementary or other grant programs that will sit side by side that will help train the many people that will be needed by hospitals, by clinics, by nursing homes to help carry out this work. So I'm going to turn it to Tammy now, and she's going to take that very first goal, the core of the program around technical assistance, and talk a little bit more specifically about what that will be.
Thanks, Jennifer. And, you know, technical assistance is such a broad kind of category, and the Office of the National Coordinator has really charged us to be on the ground and working in the communities in both Minnesota and North Dakota, providing hands-on technical assistance. And so it is of interest to note that while all of the organizations have been doing this, we will be ramping up our services significantly, and that will add about 30 jobs, most of those in Minnesota and some of them in North Dakota. And we will begin looking for those people immediately. So services that we'll be offering include vendor selection and group purchasing, implementation and project management, practice and workflow redesign, functional interoperability and health information exchange, and linking up to the exchanges. We know that we're farther along with health information exchange in Minnesota than we are in North Dakota, so we'll be using some of our best practices to help there. Privacy and security of health data and information, progress towards meaningful use and helping the providers understand exactly what that means and how to achieve that, and then also local workforce support. And all of our organizations have national level experience in health information technology and providing this type of service. So what are our service goals? We found that when we were awarded that we had taken some pretty advantageous goals, but we think that they're attainable. We want to serve 5,100 priority primary care providers over the next 4 years, and we've already secured commitments from clinics and systems representing 4,000 primary care providers across the two states. We will focus on adoption and meaningful use of health information technology, including appropriate exchange of information. The partners, who are the partners? Key Health Alliance will serve as the regional center for Minnesota and North Dakota, but we'll be working closely with North Dakota partners that we have experience working with in the past. The North Dakota Healthcare Review, which is the North Dakota Quality Improvement Organization, and also the University of North Dakota Center for Rural Health. We also have created two state-based councils of critical stakeholders. This is to ensure that other voices in the state are heard and that we are not missing any critical pieces. In Minnesota, it includes the strong e-health infrastructure, state offices, the University of Minnesota, and others. And the last slide, really, the help that we do need is to help Key Health Alliance identify the providers in your districts that need assistance, and we also need assistance with community outreach.
Any questions?
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. What I'd like to know is on the last part about assistance. I mean, what do you have some specific areas where there's really the critical need to move this forward? And if also if you could address the infrastructure, are you meeting some barriers there as well?
Sure, I can start. What we know from previous surveys that have been done across providers in Minnesota is that while we tend to, as a state, be further along in our adoption and use of technology than other states, there are some gaps, particularly when we look at rural and underserved areas. So Minnesota's electronic health record rate, adoption rate for primary care clinics is somewhere in about the 65% vicinity right now of providers that have either already begun using their electronic health record or they've signed a contract contract with a vendor, so they'll be putting it in place. But it drops by about 20 percentage points when you start to look at those small practices, rural practices, and practices that are serving underserved, underinsured communities predominantly. So we know that if we're going to not have a system where we have and have-nots in terms of technology and our ability to do that, we want to bring everyone along. So in particular, one of our outreach efforts and our commitments is to ensure that across both states that we are reaching out and engaging rural providers in ways that are really meaningful and useful for them so that they are staying on track with using technology. So that would be one specific gap that we've identified in our data and research and we will be focusing on.
Another issue that we've heard out there.
Mr. Chair, before you answer your response, is it in the rural areas, is it due to capital?
In some cases, it's due to their access to capital and resources because it is a fairly substantial financial investment. In others, it's because many of the vendors, the electronic health record vendors that are available in the micro marketplace, are designed to really serve well the large integrated health systems. So there are fewer products that are of real use and relevance. There's a growing number of them, but they have a little bit different marketplace in terms of their choice. So it's more complex in terms of their choice, and they do have a bit more of a difficult time when it comes to capital and then the ability to maintain what the expenditures are over time.
Okay, thank you.
And we've heard from many of the rural providers that this is a bigger jump for them in terms of re-envisioning their practice because they tend to be more elderly providers. And the change for them to the electronic health record, we've heard many people say, we just as soon retire as go into a whole new venture like this. And we're asking many of you to help them understand that this can be beneficial and it won't be so horrible because we're here to provide some help.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you very much for the presentation. I think the next one is actually going to be talking about how some of the small practices you're using will have a less expensive way to do it, too, which would be nice. So, Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, before we move on, I wanted to mention that I was recently in a meeting with some policymakers from North Dakota and some agency officials from North Dakota, and they expressed their appreciation with Minnesota's willingness to partner with them on this initiative. So thank you, and I wanted to relay that message. That was certainly nice to hear. And I wanted to know if you might also comment, you know, this is very exciting, and we should mention again that we were one of 32 selected, and I know in other areas of the federal funding it has been very competitive. So I think that's a positive thing to note. When all is said and done, certainly we'll be able to communicate better and more clearly within Minnesota. But can you talk about the desire to expand that portability beyond the confines of Minnesota and North Dakota?
Well, go ahead.
Sure. So the other set of grants that was announced on Friday were specifically around health information exchange. So the work that we'll be leading around providing technical assistance to providers goes hand in hand with the capabilities, not only, as you point out, within a state, but across state borders, because care is delivered across state borders. You look at our integrated health systems, or you look at our anyone who's smart in Minnesota might spend some time in warmer weather during the winter months. And what about healthcare, and how is that information exchanged? So the hand-in-hand grants that were announced on Friday to what we'll be doing to help providers is related to health information exchange. So the idea is that at some point, hopefully not too far down the road, we will have the National Information Superhighway. It's called the National Health Information Exchange, or NHIN. And the idea is that every state-based health information exchange then also has a connection to the national so that core information flows back and forth. And we've got a long way to go to get there, but I think the vision has at long last been established, and the other set of grants, which we'll be working closely with in both states, will help us move toward both of those goals.
There is proposed a national research center as well, which is supposed to coordinate out of all of these grants, including the one you'll hear coming up, best practices, so that we look nationally at what works really well in one place, can it be used in other places, so that there is that vision for a national profile that's really founded on the best work we could do.
Maybe the other part of it, specifically, Minnesota was one of the groups awarded also on Friday for the Health Information Exchange, and just over $9 million is going to our state health department, which has demonstrated terrific leadership over the past 5 or 6 years related to HIT. So the state health department here will be leading that work in Minnesota.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Sarah Higgins, quickly.
Just a quick question. So tell us once again, how much money does Minnesota get? Does it all go through St. Scholastica? I think some of us were late arrivers and not tuned in, people. So just a two-second.
$19 million of federal funding to be matched by funding that will come from Minnesota. We've proposed about $7 or $8 million over 4 years. But $19 million of federal dollars over 4 years, and that will go through Key Health Alliance, which is the partnership between Stratus Health, St. Scholastica, and the Rural Health Resource Center. So some of it will stay with our organizations because we have staff and capacity to do that, but we'll have many partners and many subcontractors across the two states. But $19 million is probably the bottom line dollar you're looking for of federal funding.
That's a lovely thing.
It's, we think it is too.
Thank you very much. Next presentation, Mr. Feinwatz and company. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Marty, and members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to visit with you today about a solution that's very compatible with the presentation you just heard. My name is Chuck Sawyer. I'm the Senior Vice President at Northwestern Health Sciences University in Bloomington. I'm a chiropractic doctor, and I represent the university on the Minnesota Provider Coalition. With me today, my colleague to the left, Dr. David Feinwachs from the Minnesota Hospital Association. He will be joining me in the presentation. We have three colleagues who will also speak briefly. Why are we here? Well, a few years ago, in its wisdom, the Minnesota legislature passed a statute that will require by January of 2015, all hospitals and healthcare providers will be required to have in place interoperable health records. And we're reporting back to you in response to this vision and mandate, and to have you focus some of your attention on the plight and some of the challenges of small providers. The vision behind this statute is clearly wise public policy, but it remains problematically challenging for thousands of Minnesota healthcare providers in ways that will hinder the effective use of health information technology for especially improving coordinated care delivery and attaining better patient and clinical outcomes, and ultimately as well lowering costs. These and other issues have been a focus for discussions within the Provider Coalition for well over a year. Frankly, large numbers of healthcare providers practicing outside of Minnesota's largest hospitals and health systems are challenged in their ability to adopt and afford electronic health record technology, and yet they play a key role in providing care to a large number of citizens, both urban and rural. Well, who are we? The Minnesota Provider Coalition is really an organization of organizations composed of over 16 members. And it's an entity consisting specifically of hospitals, medical physicians, chiropractic doctors, podiatrists, and a variety of other provider groups who came together a few years ago and developed relationships that really would have been unimaginable even just a few years ago. But because we have common interests and solutions to some common challenges, it was a natural for this group to begin to look at, among other things, health information technology. I want to just say a few things about the current electronic health problems. The current, as most of you know, the current large electronic health records systems or platforms that are in place were never designed to facilitate data exchange. And that's a key legacy consideration that is now challenging healthcare providers in their ability to easily and cost-effectively share data across these different systems. the systems that are in place in large hospitals and other similarly large settings are expensive to both adopt, to deploy, and to maintain. And as you know, they're not able at the present time to effectively communicate with each other. It's a bit ironic in as much as the different cell phone models, and regardless of the cell phone service that you have, can all talk to each other. And it seems to us that healthcare information exchange and healthcare delivery ought to at least be as important to us as being able to talk between an iPhone and some other phone, Verizon, Sprint, and so forth. The current statewide focus on electronic health record adoption seems to have lost sight of the small providers who lack the financial and other institutional resources that can only be provided, albeit at considerable expense, by the large hospitals and health systems. This is the crux of the problem, because this lack of interoperability and widespread adoption really hinders the real potential desire of electronic health records. Well, what do we need but we don't have? Well, we need an efficient and cost-effective solution or solutions for the timely exchange of patient health information. Timely, particularly in acute care situations, and efficient exchange, especially in the quest for better coordination of chronic disease management. And solutions for involving small providers in data sharing and care coordination. Patients, as you might imagine, are seeing multiple providers and providers from different disciplines for their health care. All of these providers in some form or fashion need to be and must be connected. And the solution for overcoming these barriers mostly centered around the high cost of adoption and maintenance. And then finally, we need a solution for collecting and reporting clinical quality measures without another layer of administrative burden and cost that detracts from actually caring for patients. Well, we have some thoughts regarding an ideal e-health solution. One, a statewide solution that will address the previously stated concerns. A solution capable of sharing data across providers from all disciplines, allopathic and non-allopathic alike, and all systems, both big and small, primary care clinics, individual independent offices, be they chiropractic or medical, and across urban and rural settings. And a fully functional electronic health record solution that's accessible to all providers through a form of collaborative or public utility model. We think we have a solution that's viable and would be effective, particularly for small providers, that being creating an affordable and e-commerce-enabled internet-based electronic health record that has open standards. In other words, from the ground up, the solution that we're proposing would have an open electronic window through which other systems could talk to the system that we have in mind. It would be based principally on the very successful and well-established open source Vista electronic health record, which was designed by the VA medical system and has been in use for over 20 years. Our aim is to utilize and build upon this very stable platform, a fully functional system that would have features that are not currently found in the VA Medical Center record, but which would have to be included for especially small independent providers. So what have we done? On February 1st, Northwestern Health Sciences University, on behalf of the Minnesota Provider Coalition, submitted an application to the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology in response to the request for applications for the Beacon Community Grant Program. Our initiative would initially focus on over 350 providers, largely in the Twin Cities metropolitan area and surrounding suburbs between here and St. Cloud, which, by the way, includes two VA medical centers. Unlike applications which have been submitted by other Minnesota organizations, this is truly a grassroots effort in nature and very novel in that it will create a much-needed, affordable electronic health record solution. The Minnesota Provider Coalition Initiative will focus on improving care coordination and improving clinical outcomes for patients with or at risk for developing diabetes mellitus, where, as you know, we spend a ton of money on treatment and very few dollars on prevention.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Feinwachs. I'm somewhat taken aback. This is the first time in 29 years I have appeared in this room where I am neither opposed to something nor asking you for something, so I scarcely know how to conduct myself. As Dr. Sawyer said, we are here today because essentially we're not trying to sell something. We're trying to give something away. We want to take a public domain electronic health record system developed by the United States government for the Veterans Administration, which is a workable, classy, elegant system, and we want to give it the utility it lacks, which is that being able to do medical commerce so that people who practice medicine for a living could use this system to not only perform their healing arts but also to generate claims, create bills, and transact the kind of commerce with government that's essential to being a medical provider. We want to do that in a way which creates an open source system which allows these people to share. And we want to do it in such a way that it is available to absolutely anyone who wants to use it. We don't want to force anyone to use it. We're not seeking to mandate a standard. We just want to create an interface and distribute this thing to move the ball forward in terms of not only quality medical care, but medical research and all of the kinds of things which the mandate for electronic medical records was designed to enhance and to speed up. What makes Minnesota particularly well-positioned to do this, as Dr. Sawyer said, in 2007, this legislature standardized medical billing in Minnesota to remove the multiple confusing systems and replace it with one set of systems, one system, the Medicare codes. That means if this was ever going to be accomplished, Minnesota would be an ideal site to do this because we've eliminated the Tower of Babel and created one language which everyone understands. The simplicity and the allure of this concept, as you can see, has brought together a number of stakeholders who have expressed interest in this. And again, we're not trying to sell something, but the attractiveness of being able to get so many providers connected and being immediately interoperable, if nothing else, among themselves, has garnered the interest of a huge number of organizations, which you see here displayed. The VISTA system is an accredited credential system. It's safe. It's HIPAA compliant. It does what it needs to do. We have applied for a Beacon Community Grant to gain the funding to, one, write the missing link, as it were, and get this in people's hands. But we really are excited about the potential here for bringing Minnesota from where it is now to where approximately two-thirds of medical providers have access to some kind of electronic health record system, to basically 100% compliance, with one-third of that 100% completely interoperable with each other from the get-go. There is a slide in the packet of materials in the presentation, Occam's razor, some 700 years ago. A Franciscan friar once wisely said that entities should not be multiplied beyond necessity, or in the alternative, the simplest solution to a problem tends to be the best. We believe that that logic holds true to this very day, and in fact, even more recent philosophers, such as the Rolling Stones, have said you can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you might find you get what you need. And we are trying, and we believe that this kind of system is precisely what the disenfranchised providers need. So we wanted to brief you about this exciting effort. And I'm also accompanied today by Dr. Daryl Shreve, in case we're short on doctors, from Aging Services of Minnesota, one of the founding organizations in this effort.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Daryl Shreve. I'm Vice President of Health Policy for Aging Services of Minnesota. We represent about 225 long-term care centers and over 500 senior housing organizations in the state. We think electronic health records are vital to our members, certainly as providers, but they're also vital to our residents, clients, and tenants, the people we serve, because they don't just stay in our buildings. They visit hospitals. They visit clinics. They have lab results that we need to get quickly and accurately. Those things are very slow going these days in terms of the transfer of the records. The Minnesota Department of Health eHealth Advisory Committee has identified long-term care as an area of focus in its plan. Unfortunately, the Congress did not make long-term care providers eligible for the Medicare incentives. That was restricted to hospitals and eligible providers, namely physicians and clinics. So we don't have access to that, nor are we a priority in the state's loan program. However, I mean, and in addition to that, I would say our members generally have limited access, limited resources to develop electronic health record systems. We feel it's absolutely crucial that they have that capacity to participate in a world of interoperable healthcare, electronic healthcare records. And to that end, along with our Alliance Purchasing, which is our group purchasing affiliate, we paid Stratus Health to develop the nursing home health information technology toolkit and the home health HIT toolkit. We paid them to do that. We're not making any money on it. These are toolkits that care centers and home health providers can use as they embark on their journey of adopting electronic health records. Takes them from the very beginning of trying to assess what their needs are, what resources they have, what skill sets they have, what they're missing, all the way through searching for vendors, selecting a product, doing RFPs, contracting with vendors, doing the economic analysis of the return on investment to adoption of interoperable electronic health records. We did that because we think it's important. Those toolkits are available on the Stratus Health website for free. They're available to every provider in this state or country as far as that goes. We thought it was that important. We didn't think we should make any money on that. We paid for that, for them to do that for free. We're an active participant in the Beacon Grant proposal because we hope it will expand the existing open source software originally developed by the Veterans Administration, and that it'll be available to a lot of our members, whether they're care centers or home care providers or assisted living, for free or for very minimal expense, simply because of the limited resources that our members face. Thank you.
Mr. Feinwax, you were talking about this is free because it's open source and you're going to make it available to the small practitioners. When these bigger health plans have purchased these things, aren't they talking like tens of millions of dollars for what they're buying? And what's that benefit that this – why wouldn't they use this?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think that some of the products in the marketplace today are very expensive, and they may and likely are different from this. Why people chose what's in the marketplace now is I think it's important to keep in mind that the VISTA system, without the creation of this enhancement, without some federal government grant money to create the e-billing add-on, if you will, isn't useful for what people need. If such a thing were available and I were a manager, I might tend to use it rather than pay for something else, but it would be entirely up to them. There has been a great deal of investment done in infrastructure, but as my colleague Daryl Shreve has said, that a lot of the people who are attracted to this project don't have the money for that kind of investment. They have the mandate, and we don't complain about the mandate because we recognize that effective medical care, dealing with issues of cost containment, and advancing medical science requires this. This is an essential threshold to cross. It's just that for us, this solution is the only viable one.
And this one, in effect, the doctor's office or the clinic, the small rural clinic or whoever, will get the software for free, and they need the help that Stratus and others can do to help them implement it, but it's free instead of...
Exactly so.
How much are some of the contracts with some of the bigger...
Well, I've in the packets that you've received, and I think there's an overhead as well, recently in the local paper there's been a couple of stories which may give you some insight. There's one, I think United Healthcare is promoting Ingenix, and I'm sure this is a very fine package, but basically the way that works is they want $7,000 per year per physician and a $5,000 hookup fee, which for many small providers simply isn't realistic. There's a companion article that talks about Lawson Software, who's looking at acquiring companies, and I'm this is not my quote, it's contained in the article, in an effort to try to assure that their software plays well with others. And I think that that sort of accurately describes the kind of confusion and lack of interoperability that we deal with in today's marketplace. So these things, for many providers, are not realistic solutions. The analogy I'm fond of is it's kind of like Adobe Acrobat Reader. You know, I mean, you could probably buy a PDF reader, but why would you when one of the best ones around is available for free? In this case, one of the greatest electronic health record systems has been created by the federal government and is available for free. No royalties are required to use it, to tinker with it, to write for it, to interface. It runs on Linux. It runs on Windows. It just seems sort of a natural that if you can't afford the pricier solutions, that this is where you would migrate.
And this may be, this would accomplish everything they do as well.
Well, it, from our perspective, it certainly would accomplish everything that the government is mandating that needs to be done.
Senator Dell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that note, is the if we were to adopt this particular platform, is that also compatible with, you know, the existing systems that are out there that, you know, hospitals and others are using?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, I can't really answer that question because their systems are proprietary. Could it be made compatible? Yes, it could. Will they make it compatible? I suspect if one-third of medical providers are talking to each other on a system that they would want to plug into that and will make it. If they do that, will it cost the government or us anything? Probably not, which would be a good thing. It's sort of like when other states set standards and various things follow along just as a matter of necessity. We're kind of hoping this will have that same domino effect.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Feinwalk, excuse me, I appreciate, I don't think I've ever been in a committee where Occam's razor has been presented in testimony, and I applaud that. It's, to me, a principle that maybe the legislature could profit by applying more broadly rather than just in this case. But do you know of any opposition to this idea? Are there people lined up? You listed a bunch of folks that were supporting this. Are there people lined up to say, no, don't do this? And secondly, if you could, just you mentioned in your testimony and some of the things here that we've been provided that there may be some additional functionality that would have to be developed with respect to billing and some commercial applications. Who would do that? And where would that cost be covered?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, I am not at this point available or aware of any available or existing opposition to this concept. And to your second question, obviously this would have to be a living, breathing thing. It would have to be maintained as systems change and as medical, you know, there's going to have to be some sort of maintenance of this system. We will have and have proposed in our grant a steering committee. Personally, I think that the state probably has a regulatory and oversight role in a public utility of this sort. I'm certainly not asking for that. It's an opinion that I have, but I believe that this is going to be successful either as some kind of cooperative where everybody pitches in and keeps it up and running and going, or whereas a kind of quasi-public utility like an electric cooperative or other kinds of things. It's run, but the cost of doing that and the work that's required is certainly not going to be an impediment to the benefit that these providers will receive from its operation.
What about, I think Senator Hahn might have been asking about the e-billing component you said needs to be added to it.
This is the reason that we are applying for $12.5 million for this Beacon Community Grant. That money is going to be used to generate this e-billing add-on module. And because it's federal money, you know, we certainly have no desire to make this proprietary or hold it in any way from the public. So if we are successful, and we trust we will be in creating it, it will be given freely to all who desire to use it.
Go ahead. You wanted to speak briefly as well?
Yes, please. Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Marty and committee members. I'm Dr. Todd Cunningham. I'm a medical doctor. I live with my family in St. Cloud. I am the Central Minnesota Medical Director for Center for Diagnostic Imaging. I oversee three outpatient centers in St. Cloud, the Douglas County Hospital's inpatient and outpatient imaging facilities, as well as an outpatient center in Wilmer, Minnesota. I do regularly practice in all of these communities. My medical subspecialty is body radiology. which means I focus on the torso, abdomen, pelvis. I also do breast imaging. And this is while some of my other partners subspecialize into things like neuroimaging, cardiovascular, spine, and joints. All of my patients come to us through the referral of another clinician. Our collective goal should be the exchange of information in a seamless manner that best allows for patient-centered care coordination. I can tell you that's not what we currently have in the communities I serve. The rural feeder system that we have is designed to allow critical access facilities to be maintained in rural communities, and it's under attack from the misuse of the electronic health record tool, which is meant to improve care coordination. We are seeing considerable erosion in patient choice of a provider, something more critical in a rural area where considerations such as transportation and family resources, language and cultural appropriateness may play a larger role. Currently, ill-conceived incentives at some of the larger corporate health systems are building electronic fences for patients. You're either fenced in or you're fenced out, and that includes you as a patient. If a patient in Brewton, Minnesota, which is about an hour away from St. Cloud, is told that she should come to the large metro healthcare system for all of her healthcare services because that's the only way her medical records will be considered complete and easy to treat, that patient then begins to travel there for care. They skip their local health center. They erode the already fragile feeder healthcare system that's there. In particular, that would be the Great Glacial Ridge Clinic and a hospital in Brewton and Glenwood, respectively. While this patient may be able to travel, as we know in rural areas, there are many elderly patients in those communities that depend on high-quality health care in the hopes that there is no need to travel further than they have to get quality care. This would get into transportation services, including emergency responders. And frankly, if we lose the small-town providers that we currently have in place, we will see more problems appear. The lack of interoperability between the EHR products can cause delays in care and can cause duplication in exams or testing, both of which result in unnecessary healthcare costs. So we have a new age turf war basically waging that is destructive to our healthcare infrastructure, causing needless expense and certainly not serving the best interest of our patients. Two recent examples. If a patient has an imaging procedure done in Wilmer and later ends up in the emergency room at St. Cloud Hospital an hour away, the emergency room physician cannot get access to the patient's previous report or images via electronic means, despite CDI's state-of-the-art portal that we have in place for all providers. CenterCare specifically blocks access to our portal within the hospital. We were told by a CenterCare administrator within 2 years ago that it's not in their best interest to directly link with CDI. A flip side is to this that when we request records of prior exams, that there's a delay by another healthcare provider forwarding them to us, despite the technical ability to do so. For one of my neuroradiologist colleagues recently, this became a critical situation for a patient when there was a delay in obtaining prior brain studies to compare to what was currently being imaged to detect any changes to see if there was an acute process they had to be hospitalized for. The patient had a ventricular shunt, and we needed to look for changes in ventricular size, which could indicate a shunt failure. This is truly increasing the risk to the patient. As for some exams, we end up repeating the test, which means exposing the patients again to contrast, to a secondary dose of unnecessary radiation, and delaying care. While CDI continues to successfully integrate with many healthcare providers, it's impossible to imagine a time when competing software vendors will electronically link to smaller providers, from dentists to nursing homes to chiropractors, with ease and at an affordable cost to those providers unless changes are made. It's simply not going to happen. The Provider Coalition's proposal for an open access EHR, which we larger providers can electronically link to instead of the other way around, makes the most economic, patient-centered sense for my communities. It's the most practical, responsible use of our precious healthcare resources. Thank you.
Thank you. And one more thing. In a case like, well, you work for a hospital then, or you practice in a hospital, but also?
I'm a private practice radiologist, so I'm a member of my own group like many surgeons or internal medicine doctors are, but yes, I practice.
And you already have a system in place, but in effect, I mean, this $7,000 per year per physician that Ingenex is charging, in effect, if you had this free open source software system in, you'd have the installation cost, but then you'd have ongoing would be free use, in effect.
Right, and we could easily do that. We've already integrated with literally over 100 different medical systems and local clinics and providers. So it's definitely doable. And yes, we could use that product.
Be $7,000 a year cheaper.
Yeah.
Per physician.
And why wouldn't you want yourself to have your records available to the ER doc that's treating you, for instance?
For safety.
A town
yeah.
away. Yeah.
Sir Han.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Cunningham. Appreciate you being here today. And you mentioned a couple of examples of where things maybe are not working, but you also mentioned that you talk a little bit about some things going on in Alexandria, the collaborate. Could you talk a little bit about that? Is that a counter instance of some things that are working?
Alexandria has been a location in which the rural healthcare delivery model, coming from an already quality hospital, has actually been furthered in quality. They needed specialty services for what I do in terms of radiology services and a better integration of it. And basically all of the larger providers in the community, including the hospital, came together to provide more efficient services. It's much better run than the way it had been balkanized before, to use a term. And we're getting better delivery, fewer exams, the right test done at the right time the first time, instead of repeating exams incessantly like you see in a lot of healthcare systems that I've been involved with across the country. Thank you.
One more witness? Go ahead, sir.
Senator Marty, members of the committee, my name is Christian Kohler. I'm a third-generation doctor of chiropractic. I practice with my father in New Brighton, live in St. Paul. I'm here today to testify as a member of the Minnesota Chiropractic Association, a participating member of the Minnesota Provider Coalition, and a participant in the Beacon Grant application. Most of the 2,400 chiropractors in practice in small independent practices in almost every community in the state of Minnesota. A growing number of practicing in multidisciplinary clinics, hospitals, nursing homes, and community clinics. In our small clinic, we face the real financial challenges among many other providers of implementing interoperable electronic health record that will be required by 2015. We don't have the staff or the IT department to implement such a vast undertaking. More importantly, we cannot electronically communicate with any other existing software systems in any of the clinics or hospitals that we refer to. We cannot even send the basic information reports to these other systems, so our patients either have to hand carry them or I have to call personally and try to speak to that doctor. And if you know anything about it, it's very tough to get doctors on the line. We're very busy. In many cases, this has not happened, so the patient is required to retake some of the same exams and procedures, and all that stuff isn't necessary. We need a simple solution that is cost-effective for the patient and for small providers. We are excited about the Minnesota Provider Coalition e-health solution that you've heard about today, and we urge you to get behind this project and do everything to make sure it happens. Without it, small practices that are vital to so many rural communities across the state will be left out. And the needed healthcare reform that must take place, and without connecting providers with patients, we'll be unable to improve patient outcomes and reduce healthcare costs. Thanks for giving me the time to talk to you about this. It's a real problem for rural communities and small practice providers like myself. It isn't a mandate. It's voluntary. It sets standards that we can all understand and implement, and we really need to make this happen. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a feeling you don't need a mandate here because everybody's going to do it anyway. But quick question. You mentioned something about supporting this. Is there any legislation that you're going to need in order to make sure that this, I mean, if one of the big providers, one of the health plans has got their own system in place, nobody could make others comply with theirs because unless they'd share their software coding, right? So this would, in effect, have to be it. Is there any legislation you need related to this?
Senator Marty, we're not looking for any kind of mandate at all. The people who have been drawn together by this proposal have no other options. They can't afford other things. We're not looking to rain on anybody else's parade. We're just trying to figure out how we're going to do what's best for the people we serve and develop some system where at least we can talk to each other and everybody else. So obviously we are hoping and keeping our fingers crossed on this grant proposal, but let me assure you that, you know, God forbid we strike out, we will be replacing the cover sheet and submitting this to anyone and everyone that we can think of to obtain the funding to make this a reality.
Mr. Chairman, if I may add, the existing statutory requirements at the federal level are for interoperable electronic health records so that the large systems that currently exist and have their own products will be forced under that legislation to be able to talk to each other and to anybody else in order to meet the meaningful use requirements for interoperable electronic health records. So that legislation that prevents anybody circling the wagons around their system and keeping everybody else out will be in play and in effect.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Dole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, on that issue, I think last year we had, I think I carried the legislation on some backward compatibility with certain standards with these. And I guess in looking at that and also seeing one of their first slides that the Commissioner of Health shall develop a statewide plan, is there anyone from the maybe the Department of Health could just address that briefly on where things stand as of today with this compatibility with software and maybe the development of the statewide plan? I know it's probably a full hearing, but maybe if someone's here, they could give us a couple of minutes on that.
Mr. Golden, welcome to the committee briefly, and then we'll move on because we have three bills yet as well. So welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden, the director for the Division of Health Policy at the Department of Health. Senator Dahl, to answer your question, we have been doing quite a lot, and we have been working in partnership with both of the two groups that you have just heard from. So in looking at the big plan, there really are three pieces that you need. First, you need to adopt the technology and have it. You need to use it within your care delivery. That is what some of the 19, that's what much of the 19 million that the REACH program will be working with to help people get to use that. The third piece is exchange. And in order to do exchange, you have to have standards. And to be realistic, we need national standards that are functionable so that we can pass information not only to other people in Minnesota, but to those providers in North Dakota, Wisconsin, and the other states. What the federal government is doing right now, they are establishing a variety of standards as well as certification requirements to exchange those pieces of information that providers need first and foremost. And so what Minnesota has been doing, it has been reviewing all of those standards that are set at the national level, looking to see how well they work for our Minnesota providers, making recommendations for changes, additions, deletions where they don't work for our providers, and then helping to communicate that out. So what we anticipate happening with regard to the standards is the feds will adopt them. The vendors will start to put those into their products, and we will use those to exchange in Minnesota as well as for other parts of the country.
Thanks.
Thank you. This is very promising and looks to save money and improve health all at once. Thank you for the presentation. Senator Berglund, we've got three bills. You want to start with Senate File 2243, the order that the bills are up, or it doesn't matter?
That's fine.
Okay.
Senate File 2243 is a bill that would not count certain months from July 1st, 2010 to June 30th, of 2012 against a person's five-year time limit in the MFIP program. And it's very difficult for people during this time of high unemployment to find jobs. And folks that are on the MFIP program have even a more difficult time than most. And so many of them are using up their five-year limit and not finding jobs at the end of it. And so that this is a bill that would address that concern.
Thank you. Did you want any testimony, or should we?
Yes, I have witnesses here. Make a boy and
Ms. Fitzsimmons, Ms. Galboy, and Ms. Pucher.
Hi, my name's Lyndon Galboy. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. We're also part of the Minnesota Coalition for a People's Bailout that's also supporting this bill. The coalition, the Welfare Rights Committee, fights against cuts to programs that help low-income families. The Minnesota Coalition for a People's Bailout is a coalition of social justice groups, labor unions, and religious organizations, student groups that came together in this time of economic crisis. I think my arguments are going to be the same for both this bill and Senate File 2244, which is coming up next. I'm sure everyone knows we're in a crisis. It's been going on, and these crises tend to hit the folks on the bottom a lot longer than they do the other folks in society. The unemployment rate is still very high in Minnesota. And MFIP, as small as it is, as little as it is, it is the final safety net for families who don't qualify for unemployment or families who run out of unemployment. Folks in this last 10 years have been doing whatever they could to get jobs and avoid using up their 60 months, but still many have only a few months left that they've been holding in reserve, you know, and just hoping that an economic crisis like this wouldn't hit. And MFIP parents are generally the last hired at a workplace, the first fired, or we've been working temporary jobs. And this often means that we don't fit into the little window to get the quarters needed to even qualify for unemployment. So that might not even be an option. Finally, just kind of an overall picture is that when there's nothing left for a family, nothing left for a single mother with children, oftentimes she is forced into some pretty scary and dicey situations. The MFIP grant is already super, super low. It puts families in extreme poverty. A family of three lives on $532 a month. Essentially, anyone on MFIP is homeless. And that $532 is what could be the barrier between a very dangerous and exploitive situation for a family and some kind of safety and hope. So both of these bills are temporary. Both of these bills are absolutely needed. The federal unemployment stuff is running out, and families are running out of time. And so we would urge you to support these bills.
Thank you, Ms. Dobler. Ms. Fitzsimmons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Catholic Conference. The Minnesota Catholic Conference is the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota and represents the dioceses of Crookston, Duluth, St. Cloud, New Ulm, Winona, and the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis. I'm here today to speak in support of Senator Berglund's bill, Senate File 2243, which temporarily suspends the 5-year lifetime limit for families receiving MFIP cash assistance. Because we are all responsible for all, we must address the struggles that our neighbors throughout Minnesota are facing. Senate File 2243 does this within the specific context of our state's current economic situation by pausing the clock at a time when job opportunities are scarce. The members of this committee know full well that Minnesotans throughout our state are hurting, whether they live in Rochester, Painesville, Minneapolis, Duluth, Winona, Fort Ripley. Catholic social teaching requires our community to place first our sisters and brothers with the greatest needs. This bill does that. This bill shows our neighbors that we are standing with them in solidarity. This bill creates a policy that tells Minnesota that we will not punish families who face multiple barriers and are struggling to move themselves and their families out of poverty. Temporarily suspending the time limit for families receiving MFIP cash assistance during a time when job opportunities are scarce is the just thing to do. Punishing families when job opportunities are unavailable is wrong. and furthermore, it is a short-sighted economic policy. Minnesota families who reach the MFIP time limit have significant and oftentimes multiple physical and or cognitive impairments and or disabilities. According to a 2003 report from the Minnesota Department of Human Services, 44% of parents who left MFIP as a result of time limits were found to require referral for diagnosis and treatment of a mental illness. MFIP recipients with serious barriers to employment are less likely to find jobs and more likely to exhaust their 60 months of eligibility for cash assistance. MFIP recipients who face substantial obstacles to employment are also frequently the last people to gain employment and the first to lose employment. We must work together to lighten the loads of our neighbors with the greatest needs. The role of government is to promote and safeguard the common good. The common good can only be realized when our society ensures that all of its members have the means to live in accord with their human dignity and with access to the goods and services they need to live a dignified life. Please support this bill. Poverty diminishes the lives of our sisters and our brothers and undermines the human life and dignity of all people. Thank you for your time, your leadership, and your courage, especially today in these difficult times.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify with concerns about the bill?
I do have, Mr. Chair, if I could have one question. Thank you. Senator Berglund, is this going to cost us then as a state some additional money? Do we have a fiscal note on that? Not yet. And Mr. Chair, one secondary follow-up question, fairly simple. Is there a county in Minnesota that has less 5% unemployment or less? Or?
That's the next bill.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
So I'll talk
about both.
And this bill will go to finance.
Yes.
So, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Berglund, was only just a number of weeks ago, a few short number of weeks ago, that Minnesota issued the largest number of unemployment checks ever in the history of the state. So I think the need is well-founded. I wonder, Senator Berglund, is there a precedent for this in a prior time? And I think that it would be helpful for presuming that you have a next stop with this bill to take a look at the unemployment figures in the state of Minnesota for the previous 60-month period.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lynch, there hasn't been, but we also, in the last 10 years of having the MFIP program, haven't had this huge, long period of unemployment. I think when the MFIP program was created, it was envisioned that we would probably have a fairly decent economic situation. And since we've had the program for a little over 10 years now, we've had a lot more opportunity for people to use up their time limit at various periods of time, not all at one time. And so that makes it even more difficult for families that don't have unemployment to rely on.
Thank you. Senator Berglund moves this SF 2243 be recommended pass referred to Committee on Finance. Discussion. Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. SF 2244. Similar.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this gets at the same problem in a little bit different manner. It creates another hardship extension within our law. And the first bill helps some people. The second bill doesn't help. But the second bill allows us to be able to use federal funds through the TANF program. So this would give people an extension if they reach the end of their five-year limit and they're in a county that has an unemployment rate of 5% or higher. and if they don't have any other extensions that they can qualify for. And so this is just another way to get at the same problem, but not for quite as many people. And in response to Senator Dahl's question, I don't think right now there's a county that has less than 5% employment, but there could be during this time period that's in the bill.
Okay.
But we're hoping that there are some during that time period.
Senator Berglund, you talk about other extensions. Does not, if this applies, if somebody does not qualify for another extension, what type of extensions are there right now in the law?
Well, I think Joan White might be able to answer the question better. We have some extensions for medical situations, and I'm not sure. I can't remember what all the other ones are.
That, yes, there's one for medical problems, and there's also one for, I think there's an unemployment extension, too. I can double-check real quick.
I'd just be curious about that. And your witnesses... Yes.
Well, I think that they're the same witnesses that already spoke, and it's just another way to get at the same problem, but not for quite as many people.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, the 5% seems rather arbitrary, and recognizing that we don't have those unemployment figures before us today, I would request that before the bill went to the next committee or at its next stop, that maybe those numbers could be looked at to further substantiate or help to make the case that 5% is the number that it should be at, or moved in one direction or the other.
Okay, further discussion on that? If not, Senator Berglund moves Senate File 2244. You recommend pass referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Berglund, 2336.
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment for this bill. It's an A1 amendment.
We'll get the amendment passed out. So delete everything, so.
While we're passing the amendment out, let me say that this bill is based on providing some additional services to a limited number of children in the Medicaid program who suffer from asthma that is very hard to control. And it's based on a couple of pilot projects, one done by the Department of Health and one done by the City of Minneapolis, that showed reductions in utilization of other healthcare services for children in this category when they were able to receive these services. The program in Minneapolis had savings in all three areas of hospital admissions, emergency room admissions, and outpatient office visits for asthma. And so there was a significant number of increase the number of days of school attendance for children in this category as well. So that's the idea behind the bill, and I move adoption of the A1 amendment. I think everybody has it.
Senator Berglund moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Ready for witnesses? Ms. Mann? Go ahead.
Sure. Senator Marty and committee members, my name is Melissa Reed. I'm here on behalf of the City of Minneapolis's Intergovernmental Relations Department and our Health Department. And if there are any additional, more specific questions to direct to our Health Department, we'll be happy to provide those after the hearing. Some of our staff was not able to attend today, so I'll be speaking on their behalf. As Senator Berglund mentioned, the city was received a grant from HUD covering the years of 2006 to 2009, and that grant funded our program called EACH, which is Environmental Action for Children's Health. And there was a three-pronged approach to our EACH plan that funded environmental assessments, training for outreach workers, and then the education and outreach efforts. Part of that funding also did go to provide the actual supplies that are necessary to help reduce environmental contaminants for young people, such as HEPA filters, pillows, things like that that can reduce asthma impacts for young people. The program was designed to expand and further demonstrate the cost benefits of home asthma interventions and environmental asthma triggers trigger reductions while measuring health outcomes. And part of the measuring that we did was just completed recently in the last couple of weeks, and we're going to be submitting those results to HUD in the coming weeks. And as Senator Berglund mentioned, our results were pretty astounding. The funding allowed for the interventions in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Hennepin, and Ramsey counties. We worked with 953 children in 647 housing units. The average cost per family for the interventions was $336, and we can tell you that the $336 per intervention went a really long way in reducing the asthma triggers and the occurrences of hospitalization and inpatient treatment for the young children. Hospital admissions, we reduced hospital admissions, expected hospital admissions by 49 visits for a total of just over $416,000 of hospital admission savings. Emergency visits, we estimate we reduced them by about 71 visits for a total of $67,000 of savings, and reduced outpatient office visits by 143 visits for just under $28,000 of savings. And particularly important, we think that we also saved young people about 5 days of missed school per year. We also saw tremendously positive impacts for children experiencing both daytime and nighttime symptoms, which we know can interfere with the next day's school attendance, and fewer functional limitations as well, such as exercising and being able to go outside in Minnesota's winters and things to that nature. So all in all, we think that our demonstration project has showed that a little bit really does go a tremendously long way. And we can provide some more detailed explanations about what exactly our interventions were if the committee would like to learn those.
Ms. Reed, for the $1 million you spent, you talked about how $336 per intervention and you had, and when you talk about the expensive hospitalization and so on, do you have any clue? Has anybody tried to measure how much was saved by it?
Let's see.
The front page, I can't tell if that's the...
Yeah, the numbers that I read off, those are our cost savings. When you compared the cost of the intervention, the $336 per intervention, as compared to what the expected cost of a hospital visit, an emergency room visit, an outpatient visit would be. So those numbers that I repeated that I think the committee has before you, those are our cost savings that we estimate that each household would have, not each household, excuse me, but for those different categories, what the cost savings would have been given the investment in the interventions.
Okay. And now the Minneapolis program is expired now?
We did just complete this, yes. Our assessment is being announced right now.
And Ms. Manning, the legislation is not extending the state, you're just expanding what you can cover with.
Senator Marty, the state, the legislation is requiring the Department of Human Services to cover a visit and the durable equipment. That's what the proposal is, correct, Senator? My name's Mary Manning. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm the Director of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease with the State Health Department. We worked with the American Lung Association and the City of Minneapolis and used some EPA funding to do a pilot project prior to the one that Ms. Reed just spoke about. And I was asked to just briefly talk about the program we had. We saw much the same results that they did in Minneapolis. The program required that there was an in-home visit, an assessment, an environmental health assessment to the home, and the provision of low-cost products, such as Ms. Reed referenced, the HEPA vacuums, the pillow casings, and those types of things. We spent, on average, per family, $468. That included the cost of products and the cost of a health provider, such as a respiratory therapist or a nurse, public health nurse, trained in environmental health issues assessments. And we saw, we looked at baseline, much as the City of Minneapolis project did. We looked at the use of hospitalization, the use of clinic visits, and the absenteeism prior. And then 12 months after the intervention, we again measured the families that we had the intervention with. And what we saw was we thought we saw an average of $1,900 per child that we worked with, cost savings, because what we saw was a reduction of one emergency room visit per child on average and two regular doctor's visits. And we saw a reduction, and this isn't in the cost projection, but we saw from baseline 7 days on average missed from school, and at 12 months after the intervention, we saw just one absenteeism. Now, that might be very comparable to Minneapolis. I have mine based on average per child. Theirs was overall, and they're completing their data analysis. But that was what we saw at the State Health Department. And we used EPA money for that, and that grant has gone.
EPA money?
Yes, we used a grant. We request from the EPA.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just to add, similarly, our average was 1.7 days per 3 months is how we calculated our total school days saved.
Thank you. Senator Brittner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're a little confused. I have two questions. One of them is the project over?
Both of them are over.
So what would this do? Does it extend it now? Mm-hmm. Or?
This would make certain children eligible for funding through the Medicaid program for similar services.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, why the change from medically necessary to useful? Medically necessary has a very specific definition, and I'm wondering why useful is being used. It medically necessary would imply that it would keep the child out of the hospital, I'm assuming. And
well, medically necessary has been one of the things that's kept children from being able to get this service in the law already. Now, maybe if we have enough demonstration projects but we don't have any more demonstration projects, but it's been a matter of not being able to convince the health plans that they should be covering this and they would use the medically necessary standard as the excuse for not covering it. And I think, you know, it's been really hard to convince people that this would save money. Now we have a couple of demonstrations that have showed that it does, and they're, you know, in pretty much the same ranges. But for a family to be able to get this service through the Medicaid program when they're enrolled in PMAP is probably still going to be very difficult.
So, Mr. Chair, is there a definition, though, of useful?
Senator, so it seems to be that if you have a child who is having problems with asthma and allergy pillow covers and so on that prevent that problem, I don't know if that's medically necessary to reduce it, but it's one way of reducing it. So I can see how that would fit the word useful. I don't know that we...
Well, Mr. Chair, my question is, though, I agree. I mean, I know that these work for people that have asthma. The question I have, though, is are we putting a mandate on the insurance plans for, and is there going to be an overuse by those that don't require it?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Prettner-Sullivan, we're limiting this to pilot projects for 200 American Indian children in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. And, you know, so this isn't like opening up the whole medical assistance program for everything.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, that's what I don't understand, though. Is the project over? Does this now open it up for all medical assistance children?
No, we're just
or is it still only the continuing?
This is just allowing ongoing basis 200 American Indian children could get medical assistance coverage for this.
Okay, but Mr. Chair, those 200 have probably already gotten their sheets and pillowcases. Does this allow them to get them again?
No, this would be another 200.
Okay. Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, my question is a little bit different. My question is, Senator Berglund, you were probably right in your assessment that initially this concept was a hard one to sell or to suggest that this, by doing this, would in fact save money, and now we've done that. And so my line of questioning would be kind of the opposite of the spectrum. Here we have demonstrated it through these successful projects. Kids are in school. They're staying healthier. We're helping their families. I'd like to see us move in the other direction and expanding this and broadening it to far more than those 200 children that happen to live in those select communities, in those select, you know, with that small population. My guess is that there are, even within that particular jurisdiction, that there are probably more than 200 children that could benefit from these services. So,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lynch, when we get the fiscal note on the bill, then maybe we could do that. I don't know. I mean, just because these two demonstration projects outside of the Department of Human Services Medical Assistance Program have demonstrated something doesn't mean that we've gotten as many other people to be as enthusiastic about this as you are. And so if we can, you know, if we can get fiscal savings that would allow us to be able to justify expanding it beyond this, I'd be all in favor of that. But I'd like to make sure we've got that first.
I'm with Senator Lynch on this. With a 500% rate of return, it looks like it's a pretty good deal. Buy more of it. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Berglund, on your line of thinking how this would work, there's this home environmental assessment for triggers of asthma. Oftentimes it's probably the house or the building itself that they live in. Is that when they get this assessment back, does that indicate, you know, what the source of is causing this? Was it, you know, mold in the walls and things like that? And if so, is there another avenue that allows that measure to be taken care of or to correct that situation?
Chair, Senator, what happened many times in these home assessments is there would be boxes of different medications that families would bring to the nurse or the respiratory therapist or whoever came, and they would find one of the most beneficial things about the home assessment actually was looking at the different medications and the different doctors and getting the family in line with how to use those medications. They would also take a look at some of the household products, like whether they were using Lysol or Raid or, I mean, a number of the things that actually was beneficial about the environmental assessment was teaching people how to clean up, how to identify products that probably they didn't need to be using. It even had to do more with the types of, from what I was told by the women who went in, the types of soaps and those types of perfume-type things that were in the house. While there may have been issues of mold and those things, are certainly triggers and causes. It really was more of a lifestyle home assessment that really led to a lot of the improvement.
Thank you.
I see that this is actually a 600% rate of return. I was looking at the net savings were 500%. Further discussion on this? If not, Senator Bergen moves. Senator Torres Ray.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair, thank you. I was ready to ask Senator Bergen the same question that Senator Dahl just asked, because I think that the language that you have in here presumes that there is an environmental assessment of the house. It doesn't say the lifestyle. It just says the house. And so part of, I think, what would be important is to document to what extent we need to be aware of the fact that we need to do an environmental assessment of the actual house and to what extent we are not able to do it, which will be, I think, ideal. But at least we should document that. Because by ignoring that and just simply saying that we're teaching families how to have a better lifestyle but continue to live in environments that are very toxic, and in this case it's asthma only, but we have more than that, other issues that we need to address. I think that MDH has a responsibility to document those cases and let us know, particularly among families that are low income, that live in houses that need improvement. And I would hope that as a person who cares very deeply about this, because I know you do, Ms. Manning, that you will provide that information to us. I understand that we are not able to afford it, but I think it's important that we know about it.
Chair, Senator Torres, I didn't want to lead you to believe that that was the only type of assessment. Yes, there was an environmental assessment, but when you talk about environmental home assessment, it might be a little bit different than, certainly it was looking for sources of mold and other housing issues also. But what I was just wanted to interject was a lot of the things that were identified as environmental issues in the home were things outside of just the things that you think of when you think of environmental health home assessments, and you think of the, at least in the city of Minneapolis, the environmental staff that goes and looks specifically on building things. Nurses are trained in this environmental home assessment, and it does include things like mold and those things, but it also is broader than that. So those housing issues are also things that are also assessed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Berglund moves Senate File 2336 as amended be recommended pass, and I assume has to go to Finance Committee as well. Before we get to that, Ms. Manning, did you know that I was just curious. I see that the governor has proposed reducing SHIP funding by another $10 million. How much has already gone out of the SHIP grants, do you know? And how much is left?
Senator Marty, I actually had not reviewed the governor's budget this morning. I actually took a holiday until I came to this meeting. So I, as far as what's come out of the SHIP, until now, we've had all the $47 million that was appropriated. So there hasn't been a reduction.
But I mean, how much is still ready to be going? I mean, how many grants have been paid out already? Is there still $10 million in the grants, I presume?
Senator Marty, there is the whole allocation for the next year. I'm not sure. I didn't see the budget. I don't know if you're talking about $10 million for this fiscal year still or for 2011.
For fiscal 11, he was going to eliminate $10 million from it.
There is $27 million for fiscal year 11.
So...
Senator Marty, I would just remind the members of the committee that it is health care access dollars to fund those grants.
Didn't stop him from taking a number of other things either. He was going to take one.
No, he's proposed these things before,
I know.
It's just like opening up his round file, I guess.
There was one he was going to shut down. I can't remember what the program was, but the compulsive gambling grants are not general fund dollars either, but he was taking one of them, shutting down the program and taking all the money that had been set aside from a special fund, taking the money. But Anyway, back, I'm sorry.
I invite you to come to our hearings on Tuesday and Thursday.
I do not envy you. Senator Berglund moves Senate File 2336 as amended be recommended passed, referred to Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
That meeting is adjourned until Wednesday.